Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in McDaniel versus Yarbrough. Each side has been allotted 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Ed Cochran, for that argument for the petition. He is the requirement for a
May it please the court. This appears to be the second case today involving drainage problems in the Houston streets. In our case, of course, the judge discharged the juror because there was a temporary flooding that prevented her from getting to the courthouse. And we have attacked that on behalf of, in this case, a claimant who is seeking relief. It is somewhat paradoxical that not too long ago, this court heard arguments similar to ours in behalf of a defendant that was seeking reversal of a multi-million-dollar judgment. So it is clear that this is an issue that can cut both ways. We have organized the argument in basically four portions. The first deals with the question of whether there was error on the decision of the trial judge. The second question is whether that was subjected to the harmless error rule. The third question would be whether there was some kind of waiver as contended by the respondent. And the fourth question would be the issue of arbitrary or capricious abuse of discretion as discussed in the dissent in the Court of Appeals. With respect to the first point, which is the question of error. We have cited the case of Houston Transportation Company versus Waller, which is a case that goes back over 100 years ago, but is really the last pronouncement of this court on this subject.
Mr. Common, does it make any difference that Waller and most of the precedent dates from a time when juries and civil cases had to be unanimous?
Well, Your Honor, I really don't believe so, and the reason why I say that is because the constitutional provision really hasn't changed. With respect to nine jurors being permitted to make a verdict and that sort of thing. It's changed in the sense that women were not permitted to serve on the court when the Constitution was originally adopted, things of that sort. But there really hasn't been any change in the Constitution.
What about the question of preservation of error on the constitutional question?
The question of preservation of error? The objection was made. In the Waller case, there was merely an objection made. In our case, there was merely an objection made. So, in the Waller case, the Supreme Court, speaking by Chief Justice Gould, felt that the issue was sufficiently preserved that he could discuss the constitutional question. Another aspect of that, of course, is that the constitutional issue and the statutory issue and the rule issue is exactly the same. It would seem very incongruous for the court to say that Rule 292 means one thing and the Constitution of Texas, using exactly the same language, means something different. That doesn't make any sense, and I think the question of waiver is really not appropriate as an issue in the case. Now, with respect to the Waller case, is an opinion that is, I think, very powerful just from its logic and from the way that it approaches the construction of the Constitution. The Waller case was, of course, decided very close to the time that the Constitution was adopted, when we still had the problems of when the question or the case of the semicolon was fresh in the minds of Texans, and they were concerned about what Thomas Jefferson called binding officials by the chains of the Constitution. And so the Waller judge Mr. Chief Justice Gould looked at the case and he said, disabled from sitting means disabled from sitting. It doesn't mean prevented from sitting. It doesn't mean unable to sit. It means disabled, mentally or physically incapacitated. And that was the ruling in the Waller case. And it seems to me that this is a fundamental right that has been eroded by decisions of the courts of civil appeals and the courts of appeals over the years in the Ramuda case.
Isn't the Waller result shocking today?
What's that?
Wouldn't a judge who followed Waller today be likely to end up on 2020?
I don't think so. And let me express that to you, Judge. Waller is basically decides is hewing to the language of the Constitution. Now, you say, well, it's terrible that you go all the way through a trial, or halfway through a trial, and a judge and a juror is prevented from showing up by something other than disability, and the case has to be either suspended till we find the juror, or perhaps discharged, the jury discharged. But look at it this way. Suppose a juror simply disappears, decides he doesn't want to sit anymore, and leaves. I think pretty clearly, if Waller if the situation in Waller were to come up like that, or our situation were to come under those circumstances, the court would really not have any choice, because the rule talks about being disabled. And if a juror decides he doesn't want to serve and leaves, I think it would be an incredible torturing of language to say that he was disabled.
Even if he wants to leave because his child is dying.
What's that?
Even if he wants to leave because his child is dying.
Well, if he wants to leave because of his child, the purpose of the rule is to provide some slack, so to speak, for the trial judge, but not in every situation. You can't use a rule that's designed for certain situations to cover everything. That's just, you've got to hew the language of the Constitution, in my opinion. Just because it's inconvenient to try the case further with the absence of the juror is not a means or a reason for abrogating constitutional rights. And I submit to the court that Waller is a strong opinion, and we have eroded it with the opinions of the courts of appeals, and this court may feel that some of them were justified. But I would submit to this court that a temporary flooding of the Houston streets takes the opinions, the erosion, to almost an ultimate absurdity. It just means that the trial judge has the right to do away with basically constitutional rights that our forebears, some of them I think, were willing to die for, and just puts them at the whim or caprice of a district judge.
Is there some concept, do this, the 1,000 cases in each civil district court in Houston that have not yet been reached for trial, do those litigants have some right, or there's some open court rights about how long we should delay the sitting case or drag it out in order to accommodate those litigants having 12 jurors at the expense of the people behind on the docket? I think most cases in Houston, most courts in Houston said 8 or 10 or 15 cases a week.
Well, certainly everybody has some interest in right in the efficient administration of the courts, the efficient administration of any public office. But we live in a framework of law and of constitutions, and the constitutional provisions are put in there, and they are written in the case of the Constitution of 1876. It was written in rather precise language because, as I suggest, the experience of those who drafted it was that they could be belabored by those who adopted the rule of Humpty Dumpty that words mean what I want them to mean. I don't believe that that's the rule of construction that the Texas courts have adopted. I hope it is not, and I hope it would not be the rule that this court would favor in this particular case.
Ms. Cogburn, can it not be said that since the Constitution drafted recognizing, the Constitution doesn't recognize 12-person juries, but it's certainly contemplated that that's what it was talking about. But when the Constitution gives the legislature the authority to dictate the number of jurors who have to agree, and the Constitution clearly says that you can move, you can continue to a verdict with as few as 9 jurors. Can you say that as long as this panel has 9 or more jurors on it, whether or not can it not be said that as long as the panel has more than 9 jurors on it, that the issue of disabled does not rise to a constitutional dimension? In other words, if a legislature came in and said that we consider disabled to include child care problems, could it be argued that as long as that only applies to the first 1 or 2 jurors, that doesn't rise to a constitutional dimension, and it's certainly within the province of legislature to determine what disabled is?
I really don't believe that. I really believe that words are put in the Constitution for the purpose of telling the legislature what their limits are. I believe that the term disabled has a meaning. I believe that the ordinary American knows that the American Disabilities Act does not deal with anything but people who are physically or mentally disabled. I believe that words have to have meanings, and they have to govern the actions of legislatures and rulemakers and courts. And if we have rules, we have to address them and look for meanings, and not simply say, well, this word can, as I say, as Humpty Dumpty said, and through the looking glass, words mean what I want them to mean. I think we have to follow the Constitution, and I think we have constitutional rights. And I think that anything that is in the Bill of Rights rises to more dignity than simply being the discretion or the whim or the caprice of the trial judge.
If the trial judge could excuse this juror without violating the Constitution, is there any reason why a trial judge couldn't, as a matter of convenience, proceed with the trial by 9 jurors?
Well,
if this doesn't violate the Constitution, is there any reason why the same argument wouldn't allow the trial judge to proceed with 9 jurors due to inconvenience occasioned by jury service of 3 of the 12 members of the panel?
Well, I think that is a logical conclusion. I think that is the kind of abuse, if you will, that it might lead to. But I think that the Constitution is written in such a way as to provide us with a 12-person jury unless certain specific things have occurred. And as Walgate says, that you classify disability with death. The Waller Court, Justice Gould, felt that disability, that the juxtaposition of die with disability meant that disability had to be of such a serious nature as it was put it in the same category with death. Now, that may be a little bit of an extreme position that Justice Gould might not have stayed with, but I think it registers the seriousness of what we are dealing with here. This is a constitutional right. This court, for instance, not too long ago in the Texas Wilson versus Texas Parks and Wildlife, reversed and remanded the case for new trial in a venue situation. Now, venue is, of course, an important right. It is important that a plaintiff be able, according to that case, and I think that's true, to bring suit where the statutes tell him he can bring suit. And if the courts deny him that right, this court has decided that the case should be reversed.
At the time of Waller, there was no right to have extra jurors, or what do we call them?
Alternate jurors.
The extension of that right changed the calculus here some. In other words, I presume you did not ask the judge to have any alternate jurors.
I didn't try the case, Judge.
All right.
But
your reading of the record.
But my reading of the record is there was a request to examine and determine just how much of a difficulty this lady was in not being able to get to the courthouse, whether it would take her an hour more, or whether maybe the streets would clear within an hour, or whether there was some way she could get there. The judge just peremptorily dismissed her. And we asked the court to make some further determinations, and he ignored that. As I have suggested, I think that...
Mr. Cogburn, let me ask you a question about your argument about constitutional rights. If you had been in federal court, you could have brought a case with maybe six jurors.
Six jurors, yes, Your Honor.
And in some districts, some venues in the United States, it's years three.
And in Texas, you could try some cases in the county courts with six.
All right. So how does that... what does that do to your argument that under the Texas Constitution you're entitled to a 12-person jury?
Well, the Texas Constitution says specifically that in the district courts you are entitled to a jury of 12 persons.
Not less than nine.
What's that?
No. It makes provisions for disabilities. And
yeah.
If we had been to say, well, you could have proceeded with nine.
It says you can... It doesn't say you can proceed with nine. It says that nine jurors can reach a verdict. My time has expired.
That's all right. You can answer the question.
That you can proceed to a verdict with nine. It contemplates the legislative permission for a 9-3 verdict, but it does not say that you can try the case with nine jurors unless you have the disabled consent.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from responsible.
May it please the court, Ms. Kathleen Allison will present argument for response.
May it please the court. If I may put this case in a little bit of perspective before we begin, this case was an auto accident case. The jury came back with a zero verdict on a 10-1 vote. The plaintiff did not ever raise any issue before the trial court regarding the jury verdict. They did not raise any sufficiency of the evidence points before the Court of Appeals or the trial court, and they did certainly not raise any constitutional points or any questions about them being denied a trial by jury, either before the trial court or before the Court of Appeals. And in fact, they brought this case forward on a limited record under Rule 53D, and if you've seen the record, it's extremely short. It contains only the trial court hearings at the bench regarding the dismissal of the juror and the previous excusal of the juror for a few hours.
There's two entirely different points you're making here. And one is a harmless error point, and the other is that they needed to raise the word constitutional early.
Well,
is that right?
That's right, Judge. And
but as to harmless error, we've neither this court or the United States Supreme Court has ever been very lax about that where juries are concerned. When we talk about the proper allocation of corrective strikes, there's some analysis there, but in the emerging law on Batson challenges, you get that wrong, you just get it wrong.
I agree with you on that point. However, I think that this case, it cannot be interpreted as a denial of rights to trial by jury. The plaintiffs in this case and the defendants received a full trial by jury. All the issues were submitted to the jury. They came back with a 10-1 vote, as is guaranteed by the Texas Constitution and Rule 292 now allowing the 10-juror verdict. So they did receive a full trial in this case. I think the cases that have found the harmless error rule perhaps not as strongly applied in trial by juries are cases where the parties are actually denied a trial by jury. For example, the your Housel v. De Hoyos case in 1991 out of this court, where in fact the party asked for a jury trial and was denied a jury trial.
So if the judge here had given three jurors, would that be denial of the constitutional right to a jury trial in district court as provided by this section of the Constitution?
If the trial judge had
given you three jurors, would that be okay? That would not be a denial of constitutional right to a jury?
Well, certainly the Texas Constitution, as we've discussed, allows for the for three jurors to be dismissed in the discretion of the trial court. And logically then, that would be within the parameters of the Constitution, and I don't think that would be an unconstitutional violation.
So as long as there's nine jurors in the box in district court, the trial judge has total discretion to excuse up to three members of the 12-member jury panel?
Well, that is what the Texas Constitution says, but of course it's in that only very limited situation where as many as three jurors die or are disabled.
Right.
And let me just say that constitutional provision has been in place since 1875, and I have not found a single case where there was ever more than one juror that was dismissed.
Have you ever found a case where a juror was excused and it was upheld due to circumstances like this, where it was inconvenient for the juror to come to the trial due to temporary flooding?
Well, there are numerous cases that don't comport with Waller, and certainly there's one case that's directly on point with our case, and that's the Remuda case that we cited in our brief, Remuda Oil and Gas versus Noble. And that case is directly on point. It's a 1981 case out of Fort Worth, and in that case, the juror, an elderly woman, could not return to the trial because she was because of the bad weather, and was unable to return to the trial, and she was dismissed, and the Court of Appeals found that there was no abuse of discretion, and in fact went back, and that case is a good case. It summarizes the jurisprudence that has developed over the years since Waller, and what the Court of Appeals in that case said was illness, mental disability, misconduct, drunkenness, or other facts are subject to the discretionary consideration of the trial court in determining disability. That's consistent.
I didn't see it in any of the work I was reading, and it may not be the case, but the juror who was excused for the funeral and the trial was delayed, was that juror one of the 10 or that agreed with the verdict, or was that juror the one juror who disagreed with the verdict?
I don't believe that's in the record.
If the trial had been delayed for the one juror who attended the funeral in the morning and that juror was one of the 10 who agreed with the verdict, would this whole posture of this argument be different in that the trial court actually potentially changed the outcome of the trial by allowing the trial to delay for one juror because of a funeral, but refusing to allow the trial to be delayed because of another juror who was detained by high water?
I don't believe it would have changed the outcome, Justice. The juror, even if there was one juror who was not in favor of the verdict, so even if the juror who was dismissed, Juror Seals, had been in the trial and had voted against the verdict, there still would have been 10 jurors in favor of the verdict, so
that requires you to assume that the contribution the absent juror might have made to the deliberations of the jury would have been meaningless.
Well, that's pure speculation. What
contribution? It is pure speculation, but you're speculating to the contrary, that the verdict would have been the same if that other juror had been there, or perhaps 11 to 1. They don't simply go back and vote, do they? Don't they go back and talk about it? Don't they deliberate? Don't they have an exchange of ideas and information?
I think that the answer to that is that, first of all, we have the 10-2 rule, and the cases from this court, in particular, let me point to Palmer Well Services versus Mack Truck, cases that have talked about the dismissal or disqualification of a juror on a panel, have found that you do apply the harmless error rule. And if I may just briefly discuss Palmer, and then there's one other point I want to make. In Palmer, you had a jury verdict of 10-2, and after the verdict, it was found out that one of the jurors was disqualified because he had a felony indictment. Now, this court considered that case and decided that, yes, there was harm there, applying the harmless error rule, that, yes, there was harm because that juror who was under the felony indictment was one of the 10 who came to the verdict. But it distinguished earlier cases that were the opposite, where a juror who had a felony indictment, and specifically distinguished De Leon v. Longoria, juror who had a felony indictment was in the two jurors who did not vote for the verdict, and in that case there would be no harm.
Well, that was my point. If the trial court had refused to allow the delay of the trial for the juror who went to the funeral and simply dismissed the juror as being disabled, such that you ended up in the trial of the case with only 10 jurors, you would not have had a verdict in this case. If that juror had been one of the 10, you would not have had a verdict.
Fair point. Well, in other words, if the one juror had been the defending juror,
Juror. So the trial court exercising discretion in saying, I'm not going to delay the trial for the first one who can't be there because of a funeral, but then refusing to exercise the discretion to delay the trial for the afternoon session because of another juror being detained by high water, potentially demonstrates a change in the outcome of this case.
The trial judge has to be able to exercise some discretion. There has been no effort at all to show that there was any harm by the dismissal of that juror seal. And, you know, there are cases where, for example, jury affidavits are brought back in to show harm. I mean, there has to be some way of showing harm.
Isn't violation of one's, assuming that we're just talking about harm and assuming a constitutional violation shown, violating a constitutional right to a jury trial, isn't harm inherent?
Well, harm analysis has been applied in those cases. And where, for example, in the earlier case I cited, the Halsell case, where the jury trial was denied. But yes, there is a finding of harm in those cases.
Ms. King, a minute ago you commented about a Fort Worth case that you said was directly in point where an elderly lady was prohibited because of the weather. Did her age and physical condition figure in that?
I think I said that more as putting a little color on the story. I think that the reason that the trial judge entered the ruling was because she was unable to get out in the weather. Certainly that may
because
have been part of the discretionary...
That be a physical disability?
Well, there you come back to how far are we going to stretch this meaning of physical disability from the Waller case. And certainly, you know, in our case, it would be the same situation. A physical disability to actually physically return, yes, is a physical disability. I think that what the petitioners have argued is that it has to be a physical in terms of health disability. And we're saying, of course, that that's much too restrictive, and that's not what the later cases have said. And certainly we can't tie the trial court's hands by limiting it to that sort of a limitation on its discretion, which would really result in some absurd decisions, such as that a person can be excused from a jury because he's drunk, because that's a physical limitation, but can't be excused to go to the bedside of a dying child. That is the result of applying that strict interpretation of Waller, which is, of course, why we would argue that
the judge can always recess the trial. That's no problem. Judges do that all the time, don't they? There's other things available other than granting a mistrial.
That's correct, Judge, Justice Hornan. And I think that this, you know, all goes into, first of all, we've got the constitutional provision that allows the disqualification with the discretion of the judge. I mean, I think we have to give the trial judges some credit for using their discretionary authorities and not abusing them, which we've, as I've said over the years that this constitutional provision has been in place, there's never been three jurors dismissed.
Aren't you suggesting a discretion without standards? You're saying disability can mean whatever the trial judge wants it to mean, determined by the convened court?
Well, and discretionary decision of the trial court has to be made on the basis of the facts as known only to the trial judge.
There's a constitutional standard in here that has, was initially passed over 100 years ago, of disability.
Well, first of all,
death or disability. I mean, it's not hanging out there in isolation. It's hanging out there with death.
Well, I contest the idea that Waller stands strictly for the holding that only a strict physical or mental disability is sufficient. The Waller court itself says, without trying to fully define the meaning of the term in the Constitution, so it leaves that language open. I mean, Waller does not have to be overruled. Waller leaves the language open, and later courts have developed on the language. So, I mean, it would be so limiting, as I said, would result in such absurd results to limit the trial court so strictly
How would you define disabled?
I think that it's got to be, I go back to the trial court's discretion.
But that's no definition. I mean, how can they exercise their discretion?
Well, I think they've got to consider all the circumstances of the case, the situation of the trial, the status of the trial, the situation of the other jurors, as the judge in this case, the circumstances of this particular juror, what can be done to solve the problem. I mean, this is the real reason trial courts have discretion, is because they're in the best position to know the status, to be able to make ad hoc decisions in order to progress the trial of a case.
Well, I mean, in other words, the efficiency of the docket,
That's certainly not the only reason, but in fact, the constitutional provision, if you look at the commentaries to the Constitution, in part were added for that reason. The whole idea of being able to declare a juror disabled, commentators on the 1875 Constitution say, prior to the present Constitution, if a regular juror died or became ill, or for any other reason was unable to serve, so even these commentaries expand this view, it necessitated a retrial. In view of the fact that retrials were expensive and that the convention had agreed to less than a majority verdict, it was felt imperative to prevent delay and additional costs that a trial could continue without a juror. So yes, this is one of the points that can be considered. I mean, certainly we don't want cheap justice. Cheap justice is not good justice. But on the other hand, there's no guarantee of a perfect trial.
Ms. Alcina, let's just accept your definition of disabled, which appears to be that if there's a heavy rainstorm in the city on that day, that a juror is disabled because of not being able to get out of their house and come to the courthouse. So let's assume that's your definition of disabled. Would that necessarily encompass or not encompass a juror who has a funeral in the family? Would that also be encompassed
by
disabled?
Well, all right, you're comparing the two things that happened in this trial. Let me say, first of all, that's not my definition of disabled, and that was not the fact of this case that there was a heavy rainstorm simply. And again, this is why we go back, the trial judge was there, we weren't.
Well, at least from my reading, I understand. If you don't accept that, then let's just say it's disputed in the record as to the significance, not that it wasn't flooded and they couldn't get out, but let's say it was disputed the significance of how long the delay for the flooding occurred.
Well, let's look at the trial judge's actions in the two cases. The first juror came to the trial judge the day before and said, "Judge, I have to preside over a funeral tomorrow morning. It'll take me about 2 hours, I think. I don't remember the exact amount of time. I'll be able to be back by such and such a time." The trial judge asked the attorneys, "How long is it going to take? How much time do we need for your witnesses?" The plaintiff's attorney told them. And based on that, the trial judge decided, well, okay, we'll just recess the trial until the noon hour. I mean, that was a reasonable decision under the circumstances. The second situation was quite different. Again, we weren't there. The trial judge was there, but the Court of Appeals did take judicial notice that this particular day was some of the worst flooding in the history of Houston, and you'd maybe have to live in Houston to appreciate what that means in a low-lying coastal area. But The jurors arrived at the courthouse ready for trial, and the trial judge came in and said, I have received a call from Juror Seals, who lived outside of the city a bit. She's flooded in, can't come in, and that kind of, it was not something that there was any advance notice of, as in the first case, and there was no telling when the flooding was going to cease. I mean, I think in the dissent in this case, it was a little bit unfair for the justice to Parrott to expect that the trial court would know when the weather in Houston was going to clear up. Those are not the kinds of things you can, you know, you can predict to the future, and that surely should not go to the trial court's discretion. So these were two very different kinds of decisions, and they were both reasonable under the circumstances, and I think the trial judge's decision was correct, and the Court of Appeals properly affirmed it. I see that I'm running out of time, and I'd really like to very briefly discuss these procedural issues that we've gotten into just a little bit. But in particular, this limitation of appeal issue that we've raised before you, the petitioners came to this court on a limited appeal under Rule 53D, raising one point of error, and that was the discretion of the trial court. That was the only error that was raised before the Court of Appeals. Nothing of this whole issue that we were talking about today, about trial by jury, et cetera, was ever raised until it was suggested by an amicus brief filed by Fulbright and Jaworski on behalf of Berry Property Management, and then it was raised in a second motion for rehearing. And now we're at this court considering issues that have never been raised or ruled on by the court below. Now, the limited appeal issue, I think, is almost more important than the preservation of error, because if this court gets to the merits on this case, on the issues that were never raised as an issue in the limited appeal, then what appellee in the future is ever going to be able to rely on a plaintiff's statement of what the appeal is limited to?
Wasn't it clear at all stages from the trial court up through the appellate court that the complaint was about the trial judges excusing this particular juror?
That's correct. It
so
was,
what is
the complaint was about the abuse of discretion, the trial judge's abuse of discretion. The trial judge never knew.
The trial judge can abuse his discretion in a multitude of ways. One is making an erroneous conclusion on the applicable law. And doesn't this fit in that under that definition of abuse of discretion under Walker versus Packard?
Well, the trial judge never knew in this case that he was being accused of denying someone the right to trial by jury, nor was that question ever raised at the Court of Appeals. So we were talking about abuse of discretion in a very different sense, and certainly not in these constitutional terms. And of course, the reason that we have the requirement of raising an issue before the trial court is because the trial court should be able to have an opportunity.
Are you saying if there's a Supreme Court case in point on an issue and a lawyer does not find it until they start writing the appellate brief, that's waived because the trial judge doesn't have the opportunity to see the magnitude of trouble that he or she's getting into?
Well, I think that insofar as the Waller decision talks about what the disabled from sitting language means, I think that certainly, you know, it's perfectly legitimate to bring that up at any time, and there's good.
Well, then why is the fact that abuse of discretion may be for a violation of the Constitution or merely a violation of rule, why does that make any difference?
Well, it makes a difference because now we're into the issue of the trial by jury, denial of right by trial by jury, and harmful error, which, as we've been discussing, would probably apply differently in when we're looking at a case of trial by jury and as in a case of abuse of discretion, although I hasten to add, as I've argued in the brief, this case it does not fall into the trial by jury category, and I would hope you wouldn't rule in that way.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Police court again. The Remuda case has been heavily relied upon by the respondent, and the Remuda case, I think, was substantially heavier on its facts than our case.
It's also a no written case.
I believe that's right. for instance, they said they projected 3 days before the weather conditions would clear up sufficient to allow that juror to come in, if possible. They mentioned that the juror was an elderly lady who was terrified of the weather conditions. All of these are, of course, the kind of things that the court will talk about to try to stretch the meaning of the term disabled, which I didn't feel, even in the Bermuda case, was proper, but certainly...
You don't think terror is a disability?
What's that?
You don't think terror is a disability?
I don't think it's the kind of disability that the Waller opinion would have recognized. And again, it is one of those things where you can, once you get into something like subjective terror, you've got the trial court in the position where there's just no limit to what he can do in these circumstances.
So the other thing, terror, though, is mentally disabled.
What's that?
Wouldn't you agree that someone that is terrified is mentally disabled?
Depends on how terrified they are, Your Honor. And I think that, very frankly, Justice Gould felt was suspicious of that, of those subjective type of disabilities.
Mr. Cogburn, do we have, assuming, well, the U.S. Supreme Court has come forth with some cases that tend to, that certainly, if anything else, create some sort of rights among jurors that are independent of rights of litigants in the trials of cases. Assuming that, however disabled is defined, it rises to a level of constitutional concern. Isn't there an equally competing concern of those serving on the jury not to be confined in their liberty, so to speak, by having to be called to the jury, sit on a jury of 12, and some juror now is not going to be able to come, and so the judge says, you all are subject to my control until that juror can come by. Now you're free to leave, but you've got to come back to courthouse tomorrow. You've got to come back tomorrow afternoon, maybe next Monday. Isn't there potentially a conflict between the jurors in the box and the juror who just is kind of inconvenienced for a little bit, such that a court could, within the constitutional framework, say that this juror is disabled to the extent that because of the nature of the delay, it would be unreasonable to keep these other jurors in the box just because of that one juror, when the Constitution says at least up to three who are disabled, we can continue with the trial of the case?
Well, I think that primarily the Constitution seeks to give the litigants their rights. That's the first consideration. Certainly jurors, everybody has rights in our system of law and administration of justice. Certainly everybody has some rights in the sense that they should be protected from abuse. But I think that we're a long way from abuse in this situation, frankly. We've got a very short trial that is going through here. You're not keeping us confined. Even with two jurors, even with that one day's delay, you're not really tying up for any appreciable length of time in this kind of a trial. And of course, the trial judge created the situation that we're dealing with here because he voluntarily excused one juror for the juror's personal convenience, no disability involved. And by doing so, he created a situation where the other juror was prevented from getting to the courthouse because of the temporary flight. By the way, I've looked at the opinion. I don't find anything about unprecedented flooding in the recital. It may be there, but I couldn't find it. The other thing about the jury, the question that was asked about the jury foreman, the man who was excused to preach the sermon at the funeral for the eulogy, turned out to be the foreman of the jury, and he was one of the 10 who signed on to the verdict. With respect to, my time is up, and I thank the court for my argument for the hearing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the second call, and the court will now take another brief recess.